This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Frida Liu. It's Resource Center. It's also Her Vantage, where we speak to women of influence and leadership. Ivy Josiah is a name familiar amongst Malaysians for her tireless work speaking about violence against women. She was executive director of Women's Aid Organization, WAO, for close to 20 years and is now fundraiser for the organization. She has been on BFM many times, but I haven't had the honor of speaking to her. So welcome, Ivy. And you know, you must have told this story a million and one times, but take us back to how you got involved in WAO.
Thank you, Frida. It's true, we haven't actually been together.
Hi, that's about it.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you for arranging for this. Well, it all began in 1982. I just graduated. I was a teacher at that time. And Ambiga Srinivasan, who I know from school days, we were both, you know, had all this tireless energy and we wanted to volunteer. I mean, it's part of the convent DNA, right, that you need to go out there and do good. So she pulled me into the first meeting at the refuge, at the shelter. It was a tiny little house, and it was only two bedrooms, and everybody was sitting in the living room for this volunteer meeting. As soon as I walked into that room, there was such a buzz. Everybody was talking at the same time. There were teachers, lawyers, housewives, financial people, there were survivors or victims. You know, everyone was there, and we were talking about the domestic violence in their lives or in their friends' lives or their sisters' lives. And, you know, the question was, why do men beat their wives? Mm. Why do they beat the ones they love? And there was a very clarion voice. It was a very clear voice from Simran Gill, who was our first social worker. She's now a very well-known, you know, artist. And she said, no, it's nothing to do with being drunk or being poor or being rich or being jealous. It's really to do with power. The power imbalances between men and women. It has to do with patriarchy. And as feminists, and then kind of like, I went, what, feminists? We are feminists, right? This is right. I've always known that I was a feminist, but I didn't understand it. And, you know, the early years, the pioneer spirit was there. We were known as pioneer volunteers and members. We were constantly talking. Almost every afternoon, as soon as I finished teaching, I would be at the refuge, constantly talking and searching. We're now feminists, so can we wear makeup? Do I need to shave my underarms? Because isn't it, you know, trying to deconstruct your body and trying to shape your body to men's desires? You know, it was really heady. We loved each other. We were a tiny group of volunteers. Ambiga, Simran Gill, Rashida Abdullah, Noor Farida, you know, all of these people from the early years. And we were thick. We became really good friends. I really felt that I had joined a cult of sisterhood, right? Mm. And, you know, the rest is history. I mean, I couldn't not, you know, stop volunteering. And then, of course, eventually I became staff. So I did it in the early years because it gave me answers about what was my life all about. Mm. Was I to be a daughter, a wife, a mother? What about me, Ivy, as, you know, as a person? Is my destiny only to get married and to have children? Mm. You know, so it really answers some of my own questions. And I come from a very conservative Ceylonese family. There was already a dowry in waiting, you know. I used to actually even serve coffee to meet prospective husbands. So, you know, it really rattled me that I have to pay someone to get married to me. So does that mean he's prostituting himself? And all of these early questions, all this very, you know, all this sort of personal questions, political questions. Of course, my parents were very upset, right? They were very, very upset because they thought they were bringing up a good Indian girl who would get married, have babies. But I just wanted to have a different kind of life.
So this was 1982. What were the struggles in the early days? You know, because now people know WAO, right? I mean, people. But what was it like then?
Definitely a household name in the Klang Valley.
Yeah,
I'm not sure whether it's all over Malaysia. Mm. Well, I think the early years was basically being told, "Come on, Livy, domestic violence, Malaysia. Malaysian men don't beat their wives." Mm. There was no recognition that domestic violence is actually happening in the homes. That wives are suffering, you know? And also girlfriends in all intimate relationships. So there was no recognition. And if there was recognition, it was always the woman's fault. So in the early years, the campaign was to break the silence, right? And, you know, we used to have, and when the refuge was open, we used to have welfare officers, police officers who turned away women, or welfare officers, well-meaning welfare officers who used to come and say, Ivy, all you need to do right now is just to make sure you advise these women to spray some perfume in their personal, I don't think the V word can be used on radio. But, you know, and it'll all be fine. But it was always the blame was the women. The women were not good wives. They could be better wives. They could be more submissive and so on. But really, you know, the working with the women in the early years was all really, from my life, was my volunteer time was spent looking after the women, meaning walking with them, taking them to the police stations, counselling them and so on. I really learned a lot. No matter what kind of a wife you are, what kind of woman you are. You could be a good wife, bad wife. You know, you make sure the food's on the table because, you know, in domestic violence, after a while, you figure out he wants to make sure that all the cushions are straight, the food must be warm, the children mustn't be crying. So you figure out, you keep changing your behavior. And despite that,
you still
get beaten because at the end of the day, he needs to show that he has got power, you know. So I really learned a lot about man-woman relationships, about power relations. And really, it wasn't personal. It was to do with institutionalized discrimination. Women are second-class citizens, full stop. And a man feels he's entitled to discipline his wife. And that's why he's not going out there. And when his secretary or his colleague, who is a woman who's not doing something properly, he will never beat her. He will never beat a complete stranger. But he will come back
and let it
beat his wife because he believes that the wife will give him unconditional love, no matter what. And, you know, the fact is 60% of women globally do not report domestic violence.
And that's all strata society. We're not talking just the low-income group. We're talking all.
That's one of the key things for Women's Aid, is that we were able to sort of, you know, disrupt all these myths, to explode these myths that, or drunk, must be drunk, right? Or, worse still, it has to be Indian. Or, you know, they must be going through economic problems. And I used to say to people that, you know, a woman also goes through pressure at work, you know. She too can have a really bad time at work and come back home and looking after the children. Why doesn't she just
lash it out on someone,
or in this case, husband? So we used to collect statistics in a very systematic way. So I think what's unique about Women's Aid is that we collect the data in a very, very systematic way. Rita Raj, you know, our former president who's now since passed away, you know, instituted this collection of data. You know, we have now statistics around when was your first thought, when was your first beating. You know, what triggered the beating? Do you have suicidal thoughts? How many times have you been to the police station? Why did you change your mind? You know, who gave you support? Was it your family? Was it the police? Or was it your friends? How did you know what Women's Aid? Mostly it was friends and family members who direct them to Women's Aid. So the collection of data was really very important to dispel these myths.
Right. And are we still having these same conversations? Have we progressed or have we regressed? Because, I mean, I was just meeting somebody last week and, you know, and she left an abusive relationship. She said, but, you know, it just happens once a year.
And I'm maybe the physical beating is once a year, but the mental abuse is 364 days.
Because you don't know which day of the year.
Right.
You know, and we're like, and this is, you know, someone. So have we progressed?
You know, it's really important for us to understand when it comes to domestic violence, the perpetrator wants to keep you in fear. All he needs to do is just, he doesn't have to lift a hand. He just has to look at you and you're in fear. That's enough because he knows that he's in control of your life. Definitely, I think we have not stopped domestic violence, you know. It is still there, and I think there's a lot more awareness. I think younger women are now coming out to report, which is a big difference. In the early years when I used to volunteer, women said, much older women used to come this, like, after the years of beating, after my children have grown up, and they're all okay, Ivy, so now I'm here. And I used to be, you know, really, really upset about this. You know, why do they have to wait for so long to suffer in silence? Now younger women are coming out. I think what's different now is that there is a recognition that domestic violence is a crime. And the recognition came from the fact that in 1994, you know, the Domestic Violence Act was passed in Malaysia. It was the first country in the Asia Pacific, the first Muslim nation, for want of a better word, that passed the Domestic Violence Act. You know, it was really important when the act was actually enforced in 1996. It took us 2 years to get the act, you know, to be enforced. The year after that, 1997, there was a 200% increase in police reports, Frida. It just goes to show that women were waiting for the law to recognise the pain and define it as a crime. Mm. Now we have the laws in place, we have policies in place, but really it is the effective implementation. Mm. Like I said, Women's Aid is very good at collecting data, collecting information, and we document all these cases, the good practices and the poor and the bad practices. And I think what's happening right now is that we may have the law in place, but it's not necessary that you're getting protection immediately. Mm. It sometimes takes a long time before you get an interim protection order. Or when you have an order, do the police have enough resources, enough training to be able to go and rescue you, or to be able to be there, you know, to say, yes, this is a form of domestic violence and we're going to protect you? Sometimes they feel that if the man is just coming to the house or standing outside the house or the office, that's not really domestic violence. They still very think that domestic violence is physical, right? Mm. I think the awareness is there, but actual protection, do more women feel safe? I don't think so. But I think it's really important for us to ensure that we keep up with the public education. Mm. But not only for women and young girls and families, but really also the continued education of the police, the welfare, the judges, the magistrates, and all of that. And so I think that's really important.
Okay. And then, of course, your involvement since 1982. And we'll talk about the milestones in just a moment. I'm here with Ivy Josiah, listening to Resource Centre, BFM 89.9.
In the world of manufacturing, how is the digital transformation going to affect you the most? And what is the biggest danger?
The biggest impact is going to be the connecting of all groups in a manufacturer's ecosystem. And number one, starting with the customer. How can customers connect to the core manufacturer? And that's going to be something that is extraordinarily important, because there's a huge group of manufacturers that don't connect today with their end consumer. They sell products through distributors, they sell products through a variety of different retailers, and they don't have that clarity that's going to be had from this concept of connected manufacturing that's really driving this digital transformation.
To discover the 6 big things manufacturers need to know now, download the podcast of this episode of Resource Centre featuring Sean Riley on www.bfm.my.
This is Resource Centre. Good afternoon. I'm Frida Liu. It's Her Vantage, where we speak to women of influence and leadership. Ivy Josiah here with me, and she was executive director of a women's aid organization, WAO, for close to 20 years. She was involved since 1982 and is now fundraiser for the organization. So early on, you were talking about the early days. But if you were to put the milestones over the years, you know, what would have been some of the great things? I know 94, 97, you were sharing earlier on when it became an act. That was, I think,
It took us 9 years to actually get the Domestic Violence Act going.
Yeah.
That created a movement, though. You know, even though it was 9 years, the women's groups were coming together and forming coalitions. Then another 2 years, the act is set in someone's office. So it took a protest in 1986. We actually had a little protest, 30 women, motley group, holding placards and so on. We were really, really scared. Remember those days you just get arrested for, you know. This is way before the huge demonstrations. So in 1996, we protested, and the act was passed, was enforced after 2 months after the protest. I think the milestones would be definitely for Women's Aid itself, the expansion. You know, we began as a refuge, you know, and we're still very clear that our core, the heart of our work, is really services and directly to the women and the children. But we expanded to, in the 90s, we had a childcare center was opened to ensure that the women who left their homes, that there is a childcare center, there's a place where they can place the children so that they can lead more independent lives. We opened in 2004 specifically, we opened a third center, which was primarily for public education and advocacy. This means that staff expanded, 20 staff. This also means, you know, needed more money. The other milestones would definitely be the law, the changes in the law, Domestic Violence Act. the Guardianship Act. You know, we were instrumental in providing information and making sure that, you know, mothers and fathers are equal guardians. You know, there was so much of fear. Even we had, I remember getting a phone call from a member of the cabinet saying, "Are you sure that we give guardianship to a woman, she's going to run away with you know, with the children?" And I said, "No. Actually, the research is showing it's men who are running away with the children to punish their wives." Then, of course, the big thing was federal constitution, the change in the federal constitution, the amendment in Article 8, which is about non-discrimination and equality, to ensure that women and gender is put into a particular article. And now we know the federal constitution, which is the highest law in the country, ensures that men and women are equal. Mm. Now, aside from the changes in law, right, there were all these changes in law, I think for me it's more, the milestones is more the politicization of Women's Aid Organization and the staff and the volunteers and the members. You know, very early on we realized that we shouldn't be afraid. I think in the early years there was a lot of fear.
Yeah.
You know, can we be critical about the police? Can we be critical about the welfare officer? You know, what happens, what will happen if the shelter closes? It's really important for the shelter to be opened. And I remember this one incident where, you know, the Irene Xavier, who was, you know, who was an ex-detainee, ISA detainee, saying really clearly that if you are fearful of the police, that means the police then becomes the batterer. They have become the perpetrator, and you're behaving like, you know, you're a battered wife. And the penny dropped. I realized, that's right, I can't behave. What kind of, you know, authority do I have? What kind of moral authority do we have? You just tell women, free yourself from violence,
and
but we'll just keep quiet when it comes to authorities. And I've learned over the years, the authorities do respect you if you give them the data, you give them the facts. Now, sometime in 2000, there was a huge incident in WAO that really, you know, reflected how everybody can work together to really improve the system. Around about 2000, we started taking women who were domestic workers, you know, mostly Indonesian workers who started coming into the shelter. Even that was a big debate. Yeah. Should we be opening our shelter to foreign women, right? I mean, they're migrant domestic workers. They're women in Malaysia who are suffering abuse. Now, when we had about five women at the shelter at that time. One of the women became pregnant. The father of her employer, you know, had sex with her. Whether it was consensual or non-consensual is still debated. But the point is that, you know, she became pregnant and had a baby. And she wanted to pursue this case. She wanted to make sure that he paid. She wanted to go back to Indonesia, but paid her to make sure she maintains for maintenance of the child. That's all she wanted. She didn't want to marry him or whatever. She wanted to go back to Indonesia, raise the children, but she wanted some money, some assurance. What happened was, as far as I know, this particular family wrote a report, you know, wrote an anonymous letter. They claim it's anonymous to immigration. One fine afternoon, we have 12 to 15 immigration officers at the gate, rattling at the gate. They were operating it as it was a raid, you know, like we would raid a den of, you know, of undocumented workers, what they call illegals. So they were rattling at the gate and we were like, what's going on here? And they said, open the door, open the gate, open the gate, open the gate, you know. And they were shouting, look, there are people running away, because there were women in the garden, you know, hanging up clothes or whatever. So I said, I was not going to allow them to break the gate. They're going to come in because we opened the gate. You know? So it was very important to show that all of us were very empowered. They rushed in, ran into all the bedrooms. And you should have seen the social workers, the staff and the interns. This intern was just taking a photograph and she was told, stop taking photographs. Nazlina, one of the social workers, had been there for almost, you know, 15 years or so. The phone rang and she picked up the phone automatically to start counselling, because we have telephone counselling, right? And the immigration officer said, stop it, who are you talking to? And she said, this is a counselling line, I'm doing my work. The incredible courage of my colleagues was just so inspiring, right? They hauled all the women out, especially the foreign women. They made them all sort of squat. The one woman they were looking for, they had a photograph of her, was not there. The one who was pregnant with the baby, she had gone out to the clinic. Nevertheless, they rounded the four women, put them in a car, in a van actually, and they sped off to the immigration department in Damansara. You know, the social workers and the advocacy officers, we just jumped into our cars, we followed them to immigration. We refused to budge until they released the women. I noticed this was under, immigration was under Ministry of Home Affairs. At that time, it was during the time of Pak La. Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi, and I knew Khairi, who was, of course, working, you know, as one of his officers, called him and said, what the hell is going on? What is going on here? You know, your immigration officers are here. They've raided, you know, the first women's shelter in the country. I was really, really angry. He started making phone calls. Another friend arranged for a lawyer to come in, and they kept saying, go back home. Don't worry, we'll release them tomorrow. And we kept saying, these women were brought in, are you ready for this, by police officers. They sought shelter through police officers. In fact, one of your immigration officers was in my office 2 days before the raid to talk about how to help her to get back home. All of you knew this is an official residence for. And they said, no, just go back home. You know, we'll bring them, we'll release them tomorrow. We said, no, we're going to sleep on the floor. We're just going to sleep on the floor. And they did release them at the early hours of the morning. They were very confused. They kept saying, is your shelter under the Ministry of Home Affairs? Because they didn't understand why, you know, top people were calling them to find out why you're raiding women's aid. The very next day, we had a big press conference. Every member of civil society was there. We, women's groups, WCC Penang, helped me do a press statement.
Right.
And we made it public. And the media was amazing because the media just kept asking everyone. In the following week, they asked Dr. Sri Shahrizad, what do you think of the raid? They asked Ng Nen Yen, what do you think of the raid? You know, and they all were very positive and very supportive and said, no, they shouldn't be doing raids. They should just be calling and making, you know, and they're looking for someone, have an official meeting. It played out for almost 2 weeks. Finally, the immigration invited us for breakfast to sort of apologize. The word apology didn't actually, you know, was not said, but they gave us breakfast. But in the meeting, I was very frank and honest with them to say, you know that you were doing a raid based on some anonymous letter. You know, there's something's wrong in the way you do raids. And we do not want this to happen again.
Right.
We are a gazetted shelter under the Domestic Violence Act. But it was a milestone because we all learned that it was not just the staff and the members and the women who were very brave and stood up against authorities, but we had the whole community of civil society. We had the media on our side. And it really takes all of these different institutions. I mean, I am so thankful to the media, Frida. I mean, the early stories, the 80s and 90s, we had a column in the Malay Mail, you know, and all these various journalists, you know, who are still journalists to this day, used to be very supportive of ensuring that we had interesting stories.
So for WAO to continue funding, it is through donations. How does that work? I'm sorry, use the word, but
donations are good.
So is that how WAO continues? Because I know now you're involved with fundraising.
Yes.
Right?
As soon as I stepped down as executive director, I was employed as a fundraiser on a part-time basis. I'm no longer employed as a fundraiser, but I'm now volunteer and fundraise. Okay, so yes, of course. I mean, you know, we now need over 1.5 million ringgit, you know, and the highest cost is actually the staff because, you know, we do hire professional social workers and advocacy officers and you know, and it takes, you know, a really quite a big team, even though we have quite a number of volunteers. We fundraise really through corporations. We don't get a single cent from government. We may get a little bit of money from projects here and there, but really for in terms of the for the operations, for the operating costs, the welfare has said to us that, you know, you seem to have a lot of money and we don't need to give you. So we don't get a single cent. We have not been getting any money from welfare the past, you know, almost past 10 years. So we go out there and we do all kinds of events, right? We're very fortunate to get corporate backing, but we also do fundraising events like this 22nd of April. We have a big Sheila Majid concert coming up, right? And, you know, we want to raise half a million. I mean, yes, there's an economic slowdown, but domestic violence doesn't slow down.
Yeah.
You know, it continues. The shelter doors have to be opened. Our telephone lines have to be opened. So we're hoping to raise at least $500 million. The invites are at 1,000 ringgit and at 1,500 ringgit. And we're very fortunate to have Dato' Zaharina, who is chairing this fundraising effort. So go into the WAO website and or Facebook and, you know, and do support.
So this is Dato' Sheila Majid happening on April 22nd. You can go to the website. Okay, so and of course, Sheila Majid, also CBN.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I think there is
a connection here.
I see.
All good women come from Convent Bukinanas. Hear that, Ambiga? Yes.
So after that, what will Ivy Josiah be up to?
what am I up to now? You know, I have boundless energy and I'm a very optimistic person, and I am not, you know, half empty but a half full sort of attitude, you know. I volunteer. I'm oversubscribed when it comes to volunteerism. I am an ExCo member of HACAM. I'm an ExCo member of PROHARM, which is the Society for the Promotion of Human Rights. I sit on the steering committee of Global Bursay. I am now belong to a team called PrepWorks. I'm teaching, you know, teaching young students to be able to speak better so that they are more prepared for university entrances. I'm writing. And most importantly, I'm taking 2 years off, not really earning money, but giving myself the street to just fund myself to do my master's. I want to write a book. I want to write a book about women's movement, especially through my experiences through Women's Aid Organization, a kind of an insider perspective. I want to write a book about my mother and her wonderful recipes. I lost my mother when she turned 90 in January 2015. I think I never really took time to really, you know, address with the loss. I think it took me about a year before I suddenly realized she's really gone. I'm not going to be able to talk to her anymore. And so I think this book, you know, capturing all her recipes and the conversations I've had, because she was a young woman of 16 who came from Sri Lanka, who came into this country, you know, and raised her two children, and she was able to buy three houses. And she's an amazing woman, as women tend to be, you know. So I'm just taking time off. I've been told just to say you're on sabbatical, Ivy. Don't say you're retired, because obviously I'm not, because I'm working really closely with civil society, because there are a lot of challenges out there right now. So that's what I'm doing.
All right. Writing. And we'll definitely be speaking again when the book comes out. Pressure.
I need that pressure, yes.
Thanks for being with us. You know, I'm sure we could have gone on about the many adventures over the years, but it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I've been speaking to Ivy Josiah, and this is Resource Centre, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.